From Town Hall of California, we bring you another regular weekly program featuring speakers from business, government, industry, and education. Town Hall is an impartial forum dedicated to civic education and the discussion of public questions. We go now to the meeting in Los Angeles, where the chairman of the day, Mr. James C. Green, partner in the law firm of O'Melveny & Myers and vice president of Town Hall, will introduce the speaker, the Honorable Robert F. Kennedy, Democrat, Senator from New York, who will address us. Here is Mr. Green.
Members of Town Hall and guests, Town Hall, in keeping with its policy of having presidential candidates appear on its forum to discuss their views in front of Town Hall's members, welcomes today Senator Robert F. Kennedy. 2 weeks ago, we heard in this room Senator Eugene McCarthy. Town Hall has invited both Mr. Nixon and Mr. Rockefeller to appear here, and we are hopeful that they will accept our invitations. After Senator Kennedy has... Thank you. After Senator Kennedy has completed his formal remarks, there will be a brief question period. Senator Kennedy seeks the nomination of his party. He has a broad background of government service from 1951, when he graduated from law school, down to the present day. During the 1950s, he served the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations in several capacities, and finally as chief counsel. He managed his brother's campaign for the Senate in 1952 and for the presidency in 1960. He served as Attorney General of the United States from 1961 to 1965, first under his brother and second under President Lyndon Johnson. Since 1965, he has been senator from the state of New York. He has spoken before Town Hall in the past. We welcome him back today, Senator Robert F. Kennedy.
Mr. Green and Governor Brown, distinguished guests at the head table, and ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be here. I apologize for being a little bit late. It was nice of Mayor Yorty to provide me with a police escort. It was just when we were starting to go through Pomona that I felt that maybe... I was very pleased to hear that Governor Rockefeller and Ronald Reagan are going to be invited to speak here. There's a good deal of talk, as I've been around in this campaign, about them making a ticket of Rockefeller and Reagan. I thought it was a little bit like Bonnie and Clyde opening a savings account somewhere. I'm pleased. I was very grateful for the warm handshake I just received from Governor Brown, which I hope means something. Every once in a while during this rather serious talk, I'm going to look over and smile in his direction and see and hope he smiles back. I'm pleased to have an opportunity to talk to all of you, business community, financial community, where I have such wide support. They took a poll, one of the financial magazines amongst the 500 businessmen, of the man they admired the most and who they'd like to see president. And I got one vote. So, and I understand they're looking for him. So I gather this is not a Democratic rally on my behalf. But I'm pleased to be here and highly honored because I think this, you've served in over the period of years in such a useful, valuable way for the state of California and for the United States. This year, more than in any election year in modern memory, Americans are examining their deepest dissatisfactions. Beyond the crackle of gunfire half a world away, beyond the cries of men too long denied dignity at home, beyond all this is the quiet crisis of American spirit, the sense that we have lost that personal commitment and personal control which is at the heart of the American experience. But I come here not simply to talk of our dilemmas, but to examine also our opportunities, the almost unlimited possibilities for liberating the body and the mind of American citizens with the tools that we now have before us. I come here to examine what we have and have not done with our vast capacities, the vast capacities that we have here within our own country. I come here to propose a new fusion between the genius of our private technology and the resources of our public authority, to build an America where the citizen is not enslaved by technical achievement, but freed by it, where this resource is put to work not simply in improving the quantity of our goods, but to improve the quality of our lives. We have already seen here in California what the growth of technology can bring, what it can do for us, and what it can do to us. It is here that the genius of science is building motors to power a rocket to the moon. And it is here that some of the beaches have become so polluted that many cannot be used for swimming. It is here that planes are being built to fly men across the oceans in 2.5 hours. And it is here that neglect of public transit has trapped the young job seeker of Watts 2 hours away from a decent job. It is here that the fruits of affluence have brought the automobile to millions of citizens. And it is here 60 years after the big red car took 30 minutes from city to beach that a motorist, if he is lucky, can make the same journey in 40 minutes. It is here that an expanding economy has given leisure so that men might enjoy their lives. And it is also here that we can see overcrowding and traffic congestion in the midst of the Yosemite National Park. It is here that students at Caltech, at UCLA, and other schools study at the console of a modern computer, absorbing skills and learning with awesome speed. And it is also here that the students in the ghettos of Los Angeles, trapped by irrelevant and inadequate schools, fall years behind the national reading average. These contrasts are not just California's. They are all across the face of our land. The benefits we reap from technology tell us how much can be done. The darker consequences tell us how much there is to do. America, I think, is coming to understand that indifference is a high price to pay for affluence. We are no longer willing to rest content with power boats, if these boats make our water unfit for sustenance or for recreation. We will not be satisfied merely with fine houses if they are built from the last of America's redwoods. We no longer want more and more modern highways if they pave over the irreplaceable scenic wonder and if inner city neighborhoods are destroyed in the process. What if all of us sense is the wonder that we have at our hands, is the modern progeny of fire, a profitable, valuable aid if we are wise enough to harness it, but a dangerous and destructive enemy if we are so foolish to let it master us. We now understand that the use of modern capability, like the lighting of a fire, guarantees no success in of itself and may wreak enormous harm if it is put to the use in the service of dubious ends. For we are coming to understand that there is a national agenda before all of us as American citizens. that we must begin to arrange our national priorities so that each of us, in his own way, can help fuse private freedom and public purpose in a new American Commonwealth. But it is also the simplest of ideas. It requires nothing more and nothing less than a willingness to look at our great needs, our great wealth, at our dilemmas, and our capacity and capabilities to solve them. And then it requires only the sense and the determination to unite the two. I think we can begin this work in certain specific ways. First, we can extend our existing industrial capacity to those areas where jobs, meaningful, productive, rewarding work, are now non-existent and where men languish on the welfare dole. I think we have to move away from welfare and do jobs and employment as a substitute. With a program of financial incentives, chiefly through the tax system, we can make it profitable for business to move into our urban ghettos and to our rural hollows. Only this week, the chairman of IBM, Tom Watson, announced the building of a plant in Bedford-Stuyvesant, one of our largest ghettos in the United States. More than 300 jobs will be made available by this step. Just as a mortgage pool established a few weeks ago of $50 to $100 million created for the same neighborhood will make it possible for low-income people to work toward home ownership. I think we can enlist the efforts of private enterprise in these pockets of poverty by making it profitable for business to invest there. I think you know how important this is, and I think you are willing to help. Tax credits and tax incentives are what we need now to undertake this task in a major way. I've been working on this particular project for a year now, trying to bring those who live in a ghetto such as Bedford-Stuyvesant, which is one of the worst, most crime-ridden ghettos in the United States, as well as being about the largest, bringing them together with the financial community of Tom Watson of IBM, of Bill Paley of CBS, of Andre Meyer, of many of our leading businessmen who have spent hour after hour working with the problems of those living in the ghetto, but using their knowledge and their technology and their vast experience to help those who are trying to escape the hopelessness and the despair of the past. And we've begun to make progress. It's not the business community coming in from outside telling these people what they need and what they want, but it's the people in the community working out what they think, what kind of steps are needed, and then the business community coming in and saying and making suggestions as to how it can be carried out. It's a fusion of the business community and the people who live in the local area. And it seems to me that's, in the last analysis, how we're going to find the answer to this. We've tried government programs for the period of the last 30 years. We've concentrated on welfare. We've said that if we just pay people money, if we give them a dole, if we pass them off on welfare, that that's going to be satisfactory. It's obviously not been satisfactory. And what in the last analysis is necessary is jobs and employment. And that's not going to come from the federal government in Washington. In the last analysis, that's going to come from the private sector. And it has to be made attractive for the private sector to become involved in this kind of an effort. We've done it before. We do it for digging oil wells. We do it for building grain bins. We do it for the merchant marine. Why not also do it for rebuilding our core cities, for taking people off welfare, which is so costly to a community, which is so costly to a state, which threatens to bankrupt many of our communities at the present time, substitute instead of that meaningful jobs so that these men become taxpayers instead of just on welfare. And I think the way to do that, which we've never tried before, is to have, and we haven't tried over the period of the last three decades, is to bring the private sector in an active way, not because of from charity, not because we just go in and ask you to do it as a public service or ask the business community to do it as public service, but to make it attractive for them through tax incentives and tax credits. And it seems to me that's an effort that the federal government should begin, and begin now. Second, we can employ the challenging, original techniques in the most urgent of our social tasks, and we can choose those techniques which presently work. We know that the use of computer teaching can accelerate a child's learning by as much as 4 years in one. Let us begin to use that capability in our public schools, especially in those where a child enters school already 2 years behind his more affluent colleagues. I don't think it's satisfactory that a child enters school with knowing just 24, 26 words, as many of our children do in our school. That by the time he gets to the third grade, he's a year behind. By the time he gets to the sixth grade, he's 2 years behind. And that the average child loses 10 points on his IQ between the fifth and eighth grade in the school system. Now, it seems to me it's a mistake, again, for the federal government just to pour more and more funds into the same educational system, which has not been able to educate these children. It's a special problem, and it should be dealt with in a special way. And I think that there's the capability and the capacity in the private sector, which has shown what it can do, to try to find the answer to this dilemma as well. Let us expand the use of programmed instruction and knowledge banks by channeling our aid to education toward those methods which work for the benefit of the child himself. That, it seems to me, not spending more and more money for worse and worse schools, which is what we are doing in many areas of the United States at the present time, and what an intelligent federal aid program should begin to do, and start in that direction instead. Third, we can apply these new techniques in these fields which simply have not yielded to past effort and to past concern. Massachusetts General Pilot Project has taught us how to revolutionize health care in our overcrowded, inefficient hospitals. Here we have a double standard, really, in the United States for health, for those who are poor and for those who are more affluent. Again, we can show, we've demonstrated what we can do, but there's no reason why a child born in a poor area, whether he's white or black, should be seven times more afflicted with mental retardation than a child born in a more wealthy area, or twice as much chance of dying in eastern Kentucky or eastern Oklahoma or amongst Indian reservations or in the ghettos than a child born elsewhere. We know what can be done. We've experimented with it. The private sector knows what can be done. Let's use those methods, those new methods that have been developed, those new techniques, to try to find our way out of and find the answers to some of these problems that so afflict our society. Experimental housing in Richmond, California, has taught us we can build a 7-story apartment house in a week. The urgent need is there. The capacity to meet that need is also there. Then I believe that the conclusion is obvious. Let us use our public resources and put that capacity to work, and let us begin now. Fourth and most difficult, but also most important, we must construct a method of turning private ability into the hardest of public tasks, the use of private technology for public good. This is no easy task. It requires the most careful of planning and of structure to ensure that we do not finance single, monolithic technical solutions to diverse social problems. But some principles, it seems to me, are clear. We know that with enough public concern and resources, we can build radically new kinds of abilities to solve awesome problems. That is what we did when we built the atomic bomb. That's what we did when we constructed an impregnable defense system. That is what we did when we began our space program. That is what we can begin to do now by directing government's influence toward new and unsolved problems in the cleansing of our air and our water, in the reconstruction of our urban transportation system, in the development of sources of recreation within our urban centers. We now spend almost $18 billion on research and development in public funds alone. But we have scarcely begun to put this resource to work within our own concerns here within the United States. Surely this kind of incentive offered to the men who are building for defense and space can also encourage them to build what we need so desperately within our cities and our communities and in our rural areas, so that men will walk on the moon, yes, but then walk with pride and with confidence and with safety on the streets of the United States as well. We are training almost 20,000 PhDs every year in the United States. Surely they can be encouraged through public incentive to develop for their companies and their countries the keys to better lives for all of our citizens. Nor is this a matter of selflessness or a matter of charity. Industry has prospered here because of America's commitments in space and defense. That same kind of prosperity will inevitably be a part of our national commitment to the quality of life in the United States. Indeed, it may be far more secure base on which to rest economies. For our efforts in space can be subject to political cutbacks or to diversion when other needs appear to be more apparent. Even now, we see the effects of this kind of reduced effort. But in the task of rebuilding America, the only likelihood is greater effort and greater commitment. There are 12 million substandard units of housing in this country. We will have to build more schools in the next 40 years and more homes, more housing, more factories than we have during the whole period of time in the history of the United States, just over the period of the next 40 years. Those are the tasks that lay ahead of us. And to use the technology and use the science and use the ability and use the imagination and use the initiative of the scientists, the engineers, and the business community in finding the answers to these problems seems to me the direction that the United States should move in at the present time. We must fight pollution in Lake Erie and Lake Michigan and Lake Tahoe. We must build hospitals and transit systems and parks for another 100 million people within the next few decades. And this work, with effective federal assistance, with tax incentives spurring private industry, and with the economic power of putting the jobless to work, this effort will far exceed the opportunities offered in this field of space or defense even now. So I come here today not to ask for sacrifice, but to ask for help, and most important, for your concern and for your attention for on this most dramatic and drastic and important of problems. For it is on you, really, that the decision rests. If you, as citizens of this country and this community, are willing to rest content with private affluence and public decay, then this effort by all of our country is not going to be made, because it cannot succeed by just an effort from Washington. It cannot succeed with just the federal programs that we've had in operation. If we've proved anything over the period of the last 2 or 3 years, is that federal programs operated out of Washington are just not going to be successful unless the private sector becomes actively involved in a way that they know best. Then we cannot be successful in making life peaceful and plentiful here within our own country. If you care, as all of you do, about the quality of national life, about the heritage that we're going to leave to our children, about the cancer of deprivation and want that still exists in our land, then all of us, it seems to me, can achieve that fusion of public and private effort, which can build a decent, open society where men can live to the limits of their ability and where we can link the skills that we have to the world that we seek. This is a task that is worthy of your genius and your effort, and it is a task that I wish to join with you in developing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator Kennedy. Members and guests, as I told you, the senator has agreed to answer questions.
Easy questions, if you not those hard ones. I'll repeat the question. The question was that we've all heard discussion about the problem of peace in Vietnam from the various candidates, and the gentleman said that he would like to have from me an outline of a mechanism by which peace can be achieved. Is that correct? First, let me say that I've written a book called To Seek a Newer World, in which I've outlined my views about what needs to be done and the steps that need to be taken. And I did it in much greater detail than I'll try to do it here. And if there are points in what I say, it's a detailed, complicated matter, but if there are points in which I say that you want further clarification, I'd be glad to try to answer. My first point really is that I think that the problem has been that we've made it America's war, and that I think that we've made it a military conflict, and I think it's far more complicated than that. I should say at the beginning that I was involved in an administration that where we became more and more involved in Vietnam. So when there's blame to be assessed about what is happening in Vietnam and the difficult problems that we're facing in Vietnam, that administration of President Kennedy has to share its responsibility, and certainly I do as well. I was a member of the National Security Council. I was involved in some of those matters at that time. So I don't say these things on the basis of blaming anybody or any person or any administration, but rather at what I think I recognize from my own experience and my own mistakes and the direction that we're moving at the moment. I think we looked on it as a military conflict, that we killed as enough of them compared to how many we were going to be killed of our own army that they would eventually give up. I think it was much more than that. I think that as we started to send large numbers of American troops, that the people of South Vietnam looked upon it more and more as an American war, that it was white man's war, that it was the continuation of the French effort to control Vietnam, and therefore they didn't associate themselves with that effort, an effort of independence and an effort of freedom, but either became more neutral or associated themselves with the National Liberation Front or the Viet Cong. The result is, of course, the recruitment of the NLF grew tremendously over the period of the last two or three years. There's no question we were killing large numbers of them. But if you look at the figures of who we were killing, the army was wiped out every year. But in fact, the army grew from January 66 to January 67. It increased by 50% during the same period of time, according to our own figures, plus the mortally wounded or those who were so badly wounded they couldn't enter the conflict anymore. Everybody would have been dead. So I think that their recruitment program has been successful. The military effort that we have made and concentrated on that, I think, has been a mistake. Third, I think that we have not made it clear enough that the government in Vietnam has to end its corruption and the dishonesty. I think I shouldn't think people should feel free to applaud any time that they want. I think that when we were drafting our 18-year-olds and particularly our 19-year-olds, and that they were going to Vietnam and fighting, I always felt that Vietnam should be willing to do the same thing. And I think we should have made that not only privately clear to them, but publicly clear. When they had the debate about that 3 or 4 months ago, they've started taking steps in that direction now, but when they had the debate about that 3 or 4 months ago, a member of the General Assembly got up and said, "Why should we draft our young men to fight America's war for them?" I didn't think that was acceptable. I don't think I don't think that makes me unpatriotic to think that that's not acceptable. I think that when we appropriate funds, as we do for the United States for refugees, with the definite knowledge that only one out of every $3 that we pay and spend and we raise from our taxpayer is ever going to get to the refugee, it's all going to be funneled off in the meantime, I think that's unacceptable in the United States. I think the fact that the young man could buy his way out of the draft as easily as he could in Vietnam was unacceptable. That kind of corruption. I don't think that it was acceptable to have the Commissioner of Customs be one of the biggest smugglers of gold and opium into South Vietnam. I might be old-fashioned, but I thought that and to excuse that on the basis that we have corruption within our own country, the corruption, if we have it in our country, should be cleaned up. But in addition to that, it's not costing American lives. I think we took over the major burden of the fighting. We found that we could fight better than the South Vietnamese, so that we took over the burden of the fighting. Last week, for instance, we had 350 Americans killed. The South Vietnamese army was some 290. I think the major burden of the fighting, that this is their war, this has to be carried by them and not by Americans. When our dead doubled from 1967, our dead doubled from 1967 to over 1966 and went up to 10,000, their killed in the South Vietnamese army was going down till it was less than ours. So it was quite clearly being made America's war, America's effort. I think if there were search and destroy missions of which are necessary, I think that they should have been conducted by the South Vietnamese army. We lose a third of our men on search and destroy missions, plus the fact that we destroy large parts of South Vietnam, and we've killed, responsible for the killing, as we have to acknowledge, of many innocent people. If those kind of missions have to be conducted, I think they should be conducted by the South Vietnamese army. I think the American army should be used to protect the large population centers. I would withdraw our troops basically from the DMZ and that area, again, where we've suffered such high casualties, and have them replaced by the Army of South Vietnam. Again, it's their country, it's their land, it's their war. If it's going to be won, it's got to be won by them with our help. I'm willing to give them our assistance, but I don't think we can carry the major burden of the conflict. Just if I may finish, I just think that we should go to the negotiating table. I felt in February of 1967, it was quite clear from the statements of Ho Chi Minh and Pham Van Dong that they would come to the negotiating table at that time if we stopped the bombing. Secretary McNamara testified before congressional committees that the bombing did not stop them from supplying whatever men and materials they needed into the South, so that the risk for us at that period of time was not great. We stopped the bombing in 1966 for 36 days. When they had offered to come to the negotiating table only with four preconditions, which we couldn't accept. They changed their position by the end of 1966. I think we should have taken that step, gone to the negotiating table, and seen if we could have settled the dispute then. I still think we should go to the negotiating table and see if we can settle the dispute. I think we should be willing to negotiate with the National Liberation Front. We're not giving them anything that they haven't acquired already on the battlefield. And I think that also we have to accept the idea, whether we like it or not, which has all the great risks that I know are involved in it, but that the NLF and the Viet Cong are going to play some role in the future political process of South Vietnam. Either we can do that, we can go to the negotiating table, or we can do three things. We can unilaterally withdraw, which I'm opposed to. We can escalate the conflict and continue like we are, which I think will lead to greater and greater casualties, greater and greater deaths, and will not have any greater success than we've had in the past. Or third, we can go to the negotiating table. If we can try, and perhaps we're not going to be successful, and as I said, if we're not successful, we can always go back to killing one another again. But it seems to me that at least we should make that effort. And if we said that we'd go to the negotiating table any time, any place, I think we should keep our commitment and go to the negotiating table. If the government's policy has been a failure, and I want the private sector to take over, where do I differ from the conservative philosophy? I think that something should be done. Well, to tell you the truth, the question was his opinion or judgment was that I was against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, then why don't I offer a resolution in the Senate putting in a different kind of a resolution? I don't think you understand what my position is and importance is in the United States Senate. Perhaps you wouldn't raise that question. Beyond that, my judgment is really that we have to look to the future. We can talk about the Gulf of Tonkin and what happened that night and that period of time, and I think it's all going to be terribly, I think it's going to be written up in our history books. But the fact is that the President of the United States has the authority under the Constitution to take a lot of these steps. What it seems to me is that what we should look to what the lessons that we've learned in the past and start to move on to the future and the kinds of steps that would bring a peaceful solution to the struggle in Vietnam. And I've outlined what I think needs to be taken, the steps that need to be taken in Vietnam and in our relationship to Vietnam to try to find a peaceful solution to that struggle. That's what I think is more profitable and more worthwhile. What is my opinion on the balance of payments? Now, balancing the budget, then the dollar. Well, I'm very interested in the dollar. I think that we should move in the direction of as much as is possible to balance the budget. The reason really, basically, that the budget is not balanced at the moment, the federal budget is not balanced at the moment, is the war in Vietnam, which is $30 billion. If the war was not taking place, if we were not spending $85 million a day or $600 million a week, in that struggle, then of course the budget would be balanced. In fact, there would be a surplus. It seems to me that's the direction in which we should try to move. The greatest deficit, peacetime deficit we had, was in 1958, and $12.5 billion. And I would not like to move in that direction, and I think that we moved in an important way in 1961 and 1962 and 1963 and 1964 toward greater affluence for our business community, greater profits, and greater affluence for the individual here in the United States without a corresponding inflation. There has been more inflation over the period of the last several years, 3.5 to 4%, which I think is very dangerous. It's another strong argument, as I say, to ending the war. I think that the soundness of the dollar is essential. I think one of the basic concerns that other countries have had, I think it's all related back, if I may say so, to the struggle that's going on. If other nations think that the war is going on for a long period of time, that that's going to continue to be an outflow of gold as it is, then they are going to be feel that there should be they will have less confidence in the dollar. So I would do all of that I could to, if while the war is going on, to cut down and cut back on unnecessary programs, on vital programs, of programs of that are not of the first priority of the federal government at the moment. Secondly, I would, as I say, do all in my power to try to end the conflict in Vietnam, not just because of, or obviously primarily because of the deaths and the destruction and the agony, but also because I think that it is having major repercussions not only within our own country, but in our relationship with other countries, and particularly their confidence in us. The question was, all of the evidence has demonstrated a close tie between illness, cancer, and cigarette smoking, that would I be in favor of the government restricting the amount of advertising that can be done by the cigarette companies? As I look around this room and see people light up, I think that what I would like to see, we have about between 5 and 10,000 children in the United States who start to smoke every day. We have 1 million children in high school at the present time who will die prematurely because of cigarette smoking. I think somebody who is an older person over the age of whatever it might be would, can decide for themselves what they want to do. They might find that the life expectancy of being 10 years less for a person who smokes frequently and actively than a person who doesn't smoke, that person might decide that it's so much fun smoking that they won't mind cutting off the possibility of cutting off the ears. They can make that decision. What is of concern to me is for the advertising that is aimed at children to start new children or start children smoking cigarettes. And I have met with the cigarette companies to see if they would, on a voluntary basis, cut back on cigarette advertising on television, which is watched by large numbers of children. And that would be a restriction on the times that cigarette advertising takes place. And it would be also on the kinds of programs cigarette advertising takes place. You can, in the survey, show quite clearly what programs children watch. And it seems to me we should move in the direction of a voluntary effort by the cigarette companies and by the broadcasting companies, realizing that this is a great hazard to health and poses this great problem for children, that I would like to see them move together on a voluntary basis. Whether I can be an effective leader? Well, I'm just going to make an effort so that we all perhaps understand each other better. I'm going to, obviously, I have those who are not 100% supporters, to put it mildly. But the only thing that I can do, it seems to me, is that I will go and I will speak about what my views are and what I think this country stands for and what I think we should do and what our responsibilities are, and that, and then I will answer questions. And I would hope that I agree that there are problems, but I would hope that perhaps I could break down some of those barriers. The only way that I can do it, I expect, is to campaign and to go around the country and speak before groups and answer questions. And if they leave the hall thinking I'm a danger and ruthless, then I've gotten nowhere and I'll have a difficult time. And if they don't, then I made some progress. But I don't know. It seems to me that's what a political campaign and political effort's about. That's why we have campaigns. That's why a democracy exists. And perhaps through some effort by me and perhaps some understanding on the other side, maybe I can break down some of the barriers which you mentioned. I hope so. I've cut my hair, so it was a beginning. I want to say how much they just... You did something? You want me to go? Would you like me to... I'll take one more. Now, the question was, what was my position in connection with the State of Israel in case of Arab aggression? Number one, I think we have a commitment, a moral commitment and a legal commitment to the State of Israel that must be kept under all circumstances. That I think that the commitment has been made by every administration. I think that we also have a moral responsibility of considering the suffering that the people of Israel and the Jewish people have borne over the centuries, that the Holocaust of the 1930s, of which all of us must take some responsibility for the fact that we didn't move earlier, that they were established in a country, they were established with our help in Israel, and that they have to, it has to be quite clear by everyone, and whether one be of the Jewish faith or one be of some other faith, that we have this commitment and that this commitment is going to be honored under all circumstances. And secondly, I think that we have to make that clear not only in our own country, but I think that we have to make it clear to the Arab world that in the last analysis, the only answer for the peace in the Middle East is for the Arab world to finally recognize that Israel is going to exist and that they should sit down and be prepared to negotiate with them and see if we can find a peaceful settlement to that struggle. Could I just say how much I appreciate having an opportunity to talk to this distinguished group, and that I will be in California again, as others will be, and that that I find this a great honor to have appeared before all of you and a great pleasure to have been with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator Kennedy, for coming to Town Hall. We look forward to having you back with us again soon. The meeting is adjourned.